night. Hear live performances from such local blues and R&B luminaries as LaRonda Steele, Norman Sylvester Band, and many more. Again, that's the Inner City Blues Festival live broadcast and show on Saturday, April 11th from 6 p.m. to midnight. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Portland school board elections are May 19th. What's your question?
My name is Michael Mayo. I serve as the elected secretary of the Eastside Democratic Club. Have you thought through the policy of whittling away the autonomy and the initiative of the teacher of your children?
Tune in to KBOO April 27th through 30th at 5:45 for special school board election coverage.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 11 a.m. Coming up on The Digital Divide, an exclusive interview with journalist, author, and professor Robert Scheer with your host, Rabia Yeaman. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous sustaining support. For those who are not yet a current member of the KBOO Foundation, you can remedy that situation at kboo.fm. Click where it says Donate Today.
I'm Rabia Yeaman with The Digital Divide. I'm joined today with author, journalist, and professor Robert Scheer. Robert is editor-in-chief of TruthDig.com. He was a Vietnam correspondent in the 1960s and for over 15 years served as national correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He conducted the famous Playboy magazine interview with President Jimmy Carter and has interviewed Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton, and many other prominent and cultural figures for the LA Times. He is also a clinical professor of communications at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. He can also be heard on the radio program Left, Right, and Center, broadcast through KCRW, the NPR affiliate in Santa Monica, California. His latest book, They Know Everything About You, How Data Collecting Corporations and Snooping Government Agencies Are Destroying Democracy, speaks to the government's collecting personal data on all its citizens and the ramifications that has for personal freedom and democracy in the United States. Robert, welcome to The Digital Divide.
Hi. Should I be profound? Should I say something? Let me tell you what the book's about.
All right.
Okay. We have this great contradiction. The internet is one of the great promising improvements in life. If it works the way we hope, and it seems to be in many ways, it's a great source of communication. I mean, we used to talk about having a common international language. People developed the language of Esperanto and so forth. We're getting there now, even though it's English dominated. You can do instant translations. You can read the Chinese press.
Didn't Tim Berners-Lee at some point say on, I think it was Nightline, that the internet was as profound as language?
It's definitely replaced oxygen.
It's removed logistics between people is what it does.
Yeah, let's not go crazy here. What it is a great technological breakthrough comparable to radio, television. There's no question about that. I have a website called TruthDig. It's been going for 10 years, and we could reach millions of people. And we publish people, Chris Hedges, who was the New York Times bureau chief in the Mideast for many years, and Juan Cole, who's a great professor at University of Michigan. We have really terrific people writing for us. We can't pay them what they deserve because it's hard to make any money on the internet if you're not destroying people's privacy, which is what my book is largely about. The only model that works for making money on the internet is mining people's data, spying on them. On one hand, you have this great technological breakthrough, and I welcome it. I'm not a Luddite. I love technology. I'm an early adopter. I filed stories for the LA Times on the Moscow-Stanford internet connection back in the 80s. And the real problem is that the very promise of the internet, of enlightening people and so forth, is undermined by the growing surveillance state. in our own country, but everywhere. And you have, you know, some people say, oh, it's okay that the U.S. government scoop up every single bit of personal data on everybody in the world, because, of course, the U.S. government is benign. So why should we worry? You have nothing to hide. Well, first of all, that's a betrayal of the American Revolution, which was based on the idea of suspicion of government. The whole American constitutional experiment is an assertion that even the best of people will betray you if they're left unnoticed. And so, you know, that's why we have a First Amendment and a Fourth Amendment and so forth, which is to protect the sovereignty of the individual and to give us a platform on which to challenge government. Why? Because power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. But even if you have a benign view of the U.S. government, what we saw with the North Korean alleged hacking into Sony, a very sophisticated a company, that any two-bit dictator can do what the NSA does in our government. So the coming in through backdoor channels, getting into fiber optic cables, and all of the things that our government does and indeed has glorified for the world and set the lead for the world is something other governments will do. What that does is destroy the basic vitality and promise of the internet, because instead of it being a secure environment in which you can think and reflect and so forth, it's an operation for spying on you.
Do you believe that we can still call our status as a nation a democracy, or are we past that? Are we something else now?
No, we're not past that, because we still have, and we're not the only ones. Clearly, in large parts of the world, people are either trying to improve or develop a mechanism in which the individual is not just a plaything of governments or power structures, and that this notion of individual sovereignty, which I think is the basic contribution, the clearest contribution of the United States to the world, is the idea that individuals matter and their thought process matters, and they remain the ultimate safeguard against tyranny. Ordinary people being able to raise their objections and say, hey, this is not working for me, or I don't believe you, or I challenge you. And the irony is, this is a promise that was given to us by the framers of the Constitution, who, after all, were going to be the government. They said, this is not just against the King of England. You have to have these rights and freedoms to assemble, free speech, to seek redress of grievances, to not have your home searched with warrantless searches. All of these rights have to be protected, because your government, which will be us, Madison, Jefferson, Washington, can be corrupted by power. And you have to be on guard against us. So this whole crap that I hear, and I hear it all too often from my own students, you know, the government is benign, what do they care, what harm will they will do? Well, that flies in the face of our own tradition, where we had to challenge our government and rein it in when it fought stupid wars, when it had slavery, lots of very bad things, when it wouldn't give the women the right to vote and everything. So we've had to challenge our government, and we've had to view it with suspicion. That's what is the lifeblood of the democratic experiment. And that's what got lost. It got lost stupidly after 9/11, which was hardly the most terrifying attack on a society anyone has had in the world. The excuse of 9/11 was that freedom is an indulgence. Freedom is something you can have when we have no enemies at all. We have no threats, and therefore, okay, this freedom that's in the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, and the others, and built into the Constitution, separation of powers, and all that sort of thing, checks and balances. That's all very well and good until you've been attacked, and then after you've been attacked, again, well, this is utter nonsense. Those freedoms were given to us, granted, guaranteed to us by the founders, the framers of the Constitution, not as an indulgence, but as the lifeblood of democracy. And they were, by the way, in a very shaky position. You know, the Brits could come back. They did come back in 1812, you know. But what they said is, freedom is not an indulgence. Freedom is what makes you stronger. Freedom is what you must do to prevent the destruction.
It's an entitlement.
It's the lifeblood of sound governance. So you wouldn't have a stupid war like the war in Iraq if you had actually had a free society in which Congress was playing its role, in which the voters were informed, in which we had access to what are classified documents. You wouldn't be in this stupid situation we're right in now, where ISIS, a group we were never even told about, in which was actually part of the group that John McCain and Hillary Clinton were backing in Syria against Assad, who was, after all, in religious terms, a moderate. No, we supported this based on classified information. They're all good people. They're freedom-seeking. It's like the great freedom-seeking freedom fighters that Ronald Reagan celebrated in Afghanistan when they were going up against the Soviets.
Saddam Hussein,
yeah.
Same thing.
And so now here you have ISIS, this great victory we supposedly had in Iraq, totally reversed by these people who come from nowhere that we had actually been backing, and Saudi Arabia had been backing in Syria. They're now in Iraq. And the irony of ironies, we have to turn to Iran and one of their top generals and the militia that they supported of Shiites in Iraq now to fight ISIS. So, and at the same moment, these the Republican senators tell us, oh, you can't negotiate over arms control on nuclear weapons with Iran. The same moment that Iran is bailing us out in Iraq, we can't negotiations over non-proliferation with Iran. So, yeah, I mean, so the whole thing is wacko. And the way they can continue to do it, okay, is with secrecy. Classification.
Well, that's right.
Yes. In fact, right now, Hillary Clinton's emails, if we could actually read her emails, which we do have a right to do, you know, at a certain point, the correspondence of our Secretary of State should be public record. That's what it's all about. And she didn't even trust her own State Department to right. monitor this. So how come they can monitor our emails and then Hillary Clinton blasts Edward Snowden for being a traitor because he tells us they're monitoring our emails, but she doesn't trust her own State Department? How did we get to a position where it doesn't have to make sense?
That's a really good question.
We're led by fools and we somehow accept it. I won't accept it.
I don't accept it either.
If I accepted it, I wouldn't write books like the one I just did.
Right, but that's where we are.
Which is cool, by the way. They know everything about you.
It is. And in that book, you write yeah. that the internet, while liberating, has created the illusion that surveillance and freedom are compatible. So explain that illusion.
Well, it's an illusion, a dangerous one, a deception in the eyes of the framers. And I've taken to carrying around a copy.
He's reaching into his pocket. That's that ruffling sound you hear.
I'm sorry.
It's radio in three dimensions.
But here, your voice is better than mine. This is the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Would you please share it with your listeners?
I will. This is Amendment Number 4. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath and affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. So the first question I have for you is, do you keep this in your pocket in case you have to show it to an authority?
No. I carry it around because there's such wisdom in that little bit. Okay. Now, why did we have a Fourth Amendment? Why would we have any of the Bill of Rights? Because, again, it was understood that the Constitution, without these protections of the individual and the acknowledgement that the individual is ceding power to the state, for state governments and the federal government, and that those powers are granted to be used in a proper way so that the public retains power. And what the Fourth Amendment is very interesting. The reason I bring up the Fourth Amendment is, interestingly, the Roberts Court, supposed to be a conservative court, unanimously within the last year, did one of the most positive things on this whole controversy. It addressed the question, is the Fourth Amendment an anachronism, or does it apply to the modern technological world? And before the revelations of Edward Snowden, there were people like, you know, Zuckerberg and others who said, Eric Schmidt from Google.
Do you think that he would make that same statement today?
No.
That if you feel like you have something that you don't want other people to know, maybe you should examine why you don't want other people
right.
to know it. And that was in 2009.
Yeah.
And you write about that in your book.
Both Schmidt and Zuckerberg, but they're not the only ones. That sort of conventional Silicon Valley apology for what is their main economic activity is, after all, I mean, you're not their customer. When you get Gmail, you know, you're not paying for it. You're not the customer.
Right.
You're the mark. They're getting your data, and they're going to mine your data.
They're letting me use their service, and in exchange, they're collecting all of
my
things. But I do have an expectation that my personal emails that I sent, like they might understand the searches that I do and the things that I look for, but I do have an expectation that the correspondence that I send to other people should be private, and that no one at Google or anybody else that I don't personally send it to and invite to read it should read it.
Well, first of all, the only reason you have that expectation is that the government has failed to enforce sensible consumer education rules. Everybody always throws their hands up. What can you do about it? The cat's out of the bag, blah, blah. It's garbage. And in the Clinton administration, when they did the stupidity of reversing Glass-Steagall and allowed these banks to run amok, and they said, no, insurance companies and investment banks and this is the subject of my last book, The Great American Stick-Up. So I followed that very closely. And at the time, I was working at the Los Angeles Times. And so I wrote about it extensively and interviewed people in Congress and everything. And the whole issue there from a privacy point of view was if you're going to merge the data of insurance companies, including life insurance, and you're going to merge them with investment banks and know all about your investments, and they're going to merge it with commercial banks that know all about your checkbook and everything else. In short, we're taking all of these, you know, important pools of personal data, and we're going to put them all in one place, right? And then the argument that was made by people who cared about privacy, most prominently Ed Markey, who was a congressman from Massachusetts, who's now a senator. He's now, Massachusetts has two great senators, Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey. It was a bipartisan. Bill Sapphire, who had been Nixon's speechwriter and went on to be a New York Times columnist, also championed privacy, and there were others on both the Republican and Democrat side, not too many, who said, if you're going to merge all this data, you ought to follow a principle of opt-in. You have to tell people that who gave their information to their medical insurer that you're now going to share that with somebody who might want to sell them a car or something else, or be looking at them for a job. Right. And maybe they don't want that person to know they have heart trouble or liver trouble or something. And so you should be asked specifically, do you want or do you give permission for opting in to that data being exchanged? And instead, the banking lobby, which had spent $300 million to get this bill reversed, said, no, we want opt-out. We'll give you opt-out. Which means if you think something is happening to your data and you can find out what's happening to your data, you can then say, I don't want to go along with that.
If you can figure out who to say that to.
Yeah, and if you can read the terms of agreement and everything else. So it's the exact opposite. One is real and one is a fake. An opt-in is real and opt-out is a fake. Now, Bill Clinton had the chance in pushing through this bill he did with the Republicans, he didn't hold that out. And you know what the reasoning was? Because the banking lobbies told him, if you do that, we don't want the legislation. Because the whole value in this is to be able to mine the data, this personal data,
right?
That's where we're going to get our profit. That's where Google gets now 98% of its profit. It wasn't just Google. It's all the people doing advertising.
That's right.
This is what they want. That's why when you look...
AdWords, AdSense, everybody's making a little...
If you search, targeted advertising. So if you... And this is why newspapers are out of business or going out of business. Broadcast television can't really survive because they can't... They could always promise a certain demographic and reader, but the fact is, on the internet, you can target it, and that's why you're sitting there reading and you just looked. Oh, I like to think, well, should I get a Mazda? And suddenly there's 9 Mazda ads pop up on the site.
And you only were thinking it.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, how marvelous. So people didn't make that connection, and we don't do the due diligence, consumer education and rights to say, well, wait a minute, I don't want my information shared and so forth. So that's one level of problem.
And whose job is it to provide oversight over the government and these corporations? Where is that lacking, or does that just not exist?
Well, hopefully, there was some in Dodd-Frank, some consumer protection, but there's supposed to be the Federal Trade Commission. There's supposed to be some monitoring. There is very little. Okay. In the pre-Snowden world, I would never vote for Hillary Clinton just because she called Edward Snowden a traitor. Forget her. Just really forget her. And she's somebody who once said I was her favorite columnist in the whole world when I went through the White House reception line. So I know her charm.
Talk is cheap.
Yeah, I know her charm. but the fact of the matter is, Edward Snowden did something wrong. He didn't use it. It's all garbage. This guy did what they should have done.
That's right.
He told us the truth. And he did it. But pre-Snowden, you could say, okay, I'm a fool, but I like Google. I like Gmail. Here, have my data. Do what you want with it. Blah, blah, blah. And if you do something terrible, I'll sue you because you're a private company, right? And presumably you'll tell me. Well, for what we learned after Snowden, we should have known before because there were cases and so forth, is first of all, there is no such thing as the private sector and the government sector. Right. It's a fraud. Okay? And the fact is the government, our government has pioneered this effort throughout the world. The government can chop into fiber optic cables. The government can make backdoor at Google's assets. They can get into their internal thing, and they scoop everything up. And then, you know, and they even passed a law that said when Verizon and AT&T do it and they don't tell you, or if you want to find out, they're protected in lawsuits. They don't have to.
It's not about us being protected. Yeah, yes. We're supposed to vote for these clowns, yeah. But then we actually have no power. So how does all this spying and data collection and
we have power?
How does it affect our ability to dissent against our government?
You're old enough to have maybe gone to a Leonard Cohen concert. So anyway, which I recently did a couple of times on his revival, and he has a song. You know, there's a crack in everything, and that's how the light gets through. And it's an interesting notion. It's the contradictions. It's the cracks that let light through. And the big crack here, thanks to Edward Snowden, again, I mean, and Chelsea Manning and Julian Assange and Glenn Greenwald, there are a number of heroes.
These people are courageous people who put their lives in jeopardy to tell the truth.
And very rare. The question they ask about Edward Snowden when the President and Hillary Clinton, everybody else malign him. They say there were channels. There were no channels. He was a private contract. But the real question is, there were over a million people who had his kind of level of clearance. Why didn't they tell us? Why didn't Hillary Clinton tell us? Hillary Clinton, who doesn't trust her own State Department with her email, why didn't she tell us that they were also doing the same thing to Army email? But the real problem here is that, in fact, the government's policies, once understood, as long as they could deny it, and these companies can deny it, they could say, hey, we're just multinational companies. We are out to, and their whole growth requires their having the approval, allegiance and everything of customers or people around the world. Well, wait a minute. We've had these revelations that Google or Apple or Facebook, they're just under the thumb of American security agencies, FBI, CIA, NSA, and so forth. And so how can they then go to the rest of the world and say, trust us, we are only interested in profit? You know, that used to be the justification of the multinational corporation. It doesn't matter whether it's a Turkish-owned company or a Chinese-owned company. Who's giving you the good service? Well, the very model of the multinational company, which is the basis of whatever economic success we have in the world now, that model is threatened by what the U.S. government is doing. They're saying, don't even buy chips from the United States. Don't even buy equipment. Don't buy anything, or certainly not search engines, because, in fact, you're really getting it to the CIA. And one of the things that I discuss in the book, which I think has not been explored enough, is the relationship between the CIA and NSA and FBI and the private Silicon Valley world. When I was the editor of Ramparts magazine back in the 60s and we published Martin Luther King and we exposed the CIA and stuff that they were doing. What they were doing was chicken feed compared to now.
They didn't have the swimming pool of information that they can just scoop from.
They didn't have this technology that we have voluntarily given up. And with the ability of supercomputers to mine and make the, you know, biometrics. Now with Apple, you give them your thumbprint and at the same time you have a picture there. People can look into your eyeball and compare it to 20 million other eyeballs and make a pick and so forth. So your DNA, everything is now collected routinely, your health information, your heartbeat. Right. I was just reading a debate about that new iWatch, and some watches already can monitor your heartbeat and therefore know whether it was stolen, but has Apple done enough to do that? Well, my goodness, what are you talking about? We have an identifier so that, it's bad enough that you give you a thumbprint, but now we're going to have this watch or something that you're wearing that is going to tell basically anybody in the world, because they can all hack into this information, just where you've been, who you've been with, what, you buy a book, all your commercial transactions, but not only did you buy the book, how far did you read in the book? What email did you send after you read that passage in that book? Who was at your house for that meeting? And so, getting back to the Fourth Amendment and this is the opening sentence in my book, without privacy, there is no democracy. Because people have to have a place to think, to make mistakes, to talk to others, to, and otherwise, what do you have? You have self-censorship. The most effective totalitarian societies, the whole point of both Huxley and Orwell, the most effective totalitarian society is when people have the illusion of freedom. And they've been, you know, intimidated or seduced. And then what has happened now is that basically shopping is our main act of freedom.
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up because my next question to you is, are Americans willing to give up their democracy for more online shopping choices?
Yeah, I wonder. It's very much an open question.
I mean, it sounds like a silly question, but it's a real question.
It's not a silly question. It's the basic question. And it's also a generational question. Because when I talk to my students, I say, why doesn't this alarm you? And they say, because we don't plan to. It's the same, you know, the Zuckerberg answer or the Eric Schmidt answer. We don't plan to do anything that will scare people. Well, first of all, that assumes your government is to be trusted. Now, we know throughout the world there are plenty of people who do things that get them arrested that are not things that justify the arrest, right? I mean,
Chelsea Manning exposed that we murdered innocent people by helicopter and had the video to prove it. And I think the overriding public opinion is that that person's a crazy whack job and deserves to be in prison, as opposed to, no, this person exposed, they showed that our government betrayed us in truth, and they betrayed other people, and that they actually murdered, and we have it on video, and no one seems to care.
Yeah, murdered innocent civilians, murdered, shot at Reuters reporters and everything who were covering it. But, you know, one of the assumptions of our gift to the world in terms of limited government is that we have to create a zone in which people feel comfortable being critical, because human nature probably, you know, leads to people being a bit cowardly, a bit accommodating, worried about feeding their children, worried about surviving, worried about the awesome power of the state. And I always felt, you know, being in totalitarian countries when I was writing about them, I wasn't judgmental about the people there. They should have spoken up more. I mean, I'll tell my own relatives, you know, one of the big questions I've had to struggle with my whole life, and my father was a German Protestant from, you know, Germany, and my relatives would keep coming over up to the Second World War on that side of the family, and even after. And then my mother's family were Jewish from Lithuania, and they were all killed by the Nazis. I'm an old guy, you know. I was born in 1936, so as a kid, I'm playing these games, you know, killing Krauts and burning Hitler's house and all this stuff, and have to ask myself, how come the guy with the German accent is my father? Now, I knew he was a strong anti-fascist, and my half-brother ended up that he was bombing our hometown in Germany because the German Americans were trusted in a way the Japanese Americans were not. As a young kid, I had to really think about this whole question, why didn't people speak up? And I went back to Germany many times, and I found my father's, a number of my father's relatives, found my father's brother, and who had been wounded at Stalingrad in the German army. He was a farmer. And we talked, and, you know, a lot of conversations, and the whole phenomena of the good German, or just going along, or what could you do? They were in power. Look at the terrible things that were done to us after World War. I know all those rationalizations, and I've talked to people in other cultures that go along. Most people go along. The assumption of our Constitution is to create an environment in which people who don't go along and challenge the government and raise important questions are treated with some kind of protection. This goes back to the Magna Carta. And the whole thing of the Fourth Amendment was, okay, we have a king by divine right. But still, that the agents of that king cannot go into the home of the poorest peasant in the land, rummage about in that home to find evidence of a crime. Either you have a specific reason for entering that home, or you have no right to enter that home. Okay. That was the idea of it. That's where the Fourth Amendment comes from. And the reason, and in Justice Roberts' decision, which I think was incredibly important, and the cell phone case and the police smartphones, they said You know, the American Revolution started over the Fourth Amendment. And that's what the Boston Tea Party was about. That's what the whole original Sons of Liberty argument was about, fight was about, is that the agents of the king could not come into your home with a warrantless search or a general warrant saying we're going to look everywhere. They had to have a specific reason, what they were after, and so forth. And finally, the Supreme Court, which has been asleep at the switch, decided in this very important case involving the smartphones. They said a couple of things. But Roberts, in his decision, brought up the original American Revolution, said that's the idea. That's what was the spark that started the American Revolution. And secondly, there's more information on that smartphone than was ever in anybody's home.
Right.
Everything, your diaries, your thoughts, your records, everything, your whole life is there. And instead of accepting the argument that Schmidt of Google and Zuckerberg were making back then, which they now abandoned because it's embarrassing, instead of accepting it, they said, no, the new technology doesn't trump the Fourth Amendment. It is precisely the reason why we need a reinvigorated Fourth Amendment to include smartphones. Yes, the founders didn't know about smartphones, but they certainly did not want your personal data that you had collected, your books you're reading, your thoughts, your pamphlets, your phone, you know, anything. They didn't want the authorities to be able to just go and grab it in some kind of general search, because then you would be living in an intimidated society. You would engage in self-censorship. You would be afraid to speculate. You would be afraid to challenge. You would not be free people.
I'm Rabia Yemen, and I am talking today with Robert Scheer, author of They Know Everything About You, How Data Collecting Corporations and Snooping Government Agencies Are Destroying Democracy. Snowden, he's heroic. The documentary about his life, or about this event, it's not really about his life, but the documentary.
I wasn't there because I can't afford $7,500. What was so interesting was they did applaud him. He got a standing ovation at the end.
Tim Berners-Lee got up on the stage and interviewed him. It was so exciting to me.
Yeah, you know, by the way, the website that I edit, Truth Dig, we've won 5 Webbies in our 10 years or 9 years, and Tim Berners-Lee was at the last Webby and gave a very strong statement on net neutrality, and we talked about Aaron Swartz. And the interesting thing about that TED Talk, that what you're describing is a piped in Edward Snowden on top of a robot, and it was really bizarre. And then you had Sergey, from Google, with his arm around the robot, and all that.
Yet he had selfie,
been,
I think.
Yeah, but he had been involved with the Pentagon and all sorts of these manipulations. The strange thing about this is that there was an intuitive feeling that Edward Snowden's one of the good guys, because that was just the question that was put to the audience. So basically, if you had to choose, and they went for him. And I think there is a feeling that we are saved by these people, that they're whether it's Daniel Ellsberger on the Pentagon Wars, Edward Snowden, Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, any of these people, the saving grace of American society is that at the end of the day, there are people, whether they're Tom Paine historically or others, that are willing to stand up and be counted for saving the system from itself.
And make a sacrifice, really. I mean, all these people are making... Daniel came out, well, because of the time, and the government didn't have the kind of power and technology that they could abuse you with now. Or the post-9/11, hysteria. Yeah. So do you think our government just uses terrorism as a ruse to spy on us?
The reason terrorism is the gift that will keep on giving to the military-industrial complex is there has always been terrorism. From the first day some cave dweller picked up a rock and got angry with some tribal chief he thought was an oppressor. There's always going to be mayhem. There's always going to be,
And we haven't experienced those types of, that other countries experience on a regular basis.
I understand that. Yeah. But the problem here is, when do you stand up? When do you say careerism doesn't trump everything? The amazing thing about Edward Snowden or Daniel Ellsberg, these guys had good lives, had good salaries, and they suddenly said, hey, wait a minute, no, this is wrong.
They couldn't abide by it.
I was at Ellsberg's trial, and we may now think he got off easy, but that guy was looking at 130 years. Interesting, I have 2 blurbs on the back of my book that I'm particularly proud of. One is from Daniel Ellsberg, and one is from John Dean, who was the White House counsel. They're both honorable people, and they're both honest people. But it's interesting, because the only reason the Ellsberg case was never resolved legally. What happened was that Richard Nixon overreached, and his government tried to give the judge, Judge Burns, a job as some higher, Supreme Court, actually, yeah, Supreme Court, and was talking to him about it. And that when that came out, and wouldn't have come out except, I guess, some little whistleblowing act by somebody, and then that, there was a mistrial. And Burns had to, and then the government decided not to pursue it because the whole case was very weak. I mean, because what Ellsberg was able to show, that is a lot of this material had been selectively leaked by the government to support its case. The fact of the matter is 95-97% of what you read in a newspaper or watch on television or anything about foreign policy and national security is based on leaked information, selectively
that's
leaked.
That's right. It's like the government is writing the news that we're all watching.
And that's what really is.
It's just
what,
like a propaganda machine.
That's what classification is all about. You know, how can we spin the story? How can you support the government? Mm-hmm. It's only when classified information is revealed that shows torture, shows irrational policies, shows, you know, goes against their narrative that there's this crackdown on it, you know. And I know this. I worked 29 years in one way or another for the Los Angeles Times. I was routinely given information that was classified, you know, just don't attribute it to this. So it was, it happened all the time. It's the norm. And so what is called a whistleblower, you know, what the ones they go after are people who tell us what we need to know that makes the government uncomfortable. And you're right. You're absolutely right about Chelsea Manning. We're killing civilians. We're shooting at reporters. You know, oh, wait a minute. We don't want that out there. Chelsea Manning, go
put
30,
him in a cage.
35 years in jail. I will never vote for a politician who thinks Chelsea Manning deserves to be in jail. I just won't. I don't care who they are. I don't care if they're the lesser evil. I don't care what they tell me. But if they think Chelsea Manning or Edward Snowden or, you know, any of these people, Julian Assange, deserve to be in jail, then you don't believe in freedom.
For informing
you know,
us.
Because,
that's right.
Yes, for informing us. And so you can sit at some dinner party and somebody very rationally say, we have to have secrets. Well, let me just address the secrets question, first of all, that it makes us stronger. No, it makes us weaker.
Do you use any software or tools to encrypt your own communications?
I should, but I don't do it for two reasons. I don't want to discourage anyone from doing it. But I just assume at this stage that my own government is so vicious and virulent and aggressive in destroying the freedom of anyone, certainly someone like myself who would write a book like this, that they've got their cameras up my, you know, or something. I mean, I'm not naive. I've been around a long time and I've seen my own big chunks of my own FBI and CIA files and everything. And so I know even in the old days how aggressive the government could be. So my own feeling is, I just cannot conduct myself that way. If I actually sit around thinking of all the terrible things the government can do to you, which are real, and I let that intimidate me, they've won. I'm not making the argument against encryption. And in my case, at my age, it really slows me down. I don't have a staff, and I just can't be doing all that.
Robert, you've spent your career trying to inform the public, your readers, your listeners about the value of democracy. Do you feel that your work has been somewhat in vain?
No. Our work, by the way. I never saw it as an individual. First of all, I haven't suffered. Okay? Let's be clear about that. I'm not sitting here, you know, oh, woe is me. I've had a great life. Right. Okay, I'm going to be 79 in a couple of weeks. And
you had an amazing life.
No, and I'm in a good shape. I swim, I run, you know, I mean, I do the whole thing, you know, and I enjoy life, you know. And
But are you seeing the public become more complacent instead of more active?
No. What I see is a great contradiction, a word I use quite often. If you can get students interested, and I've seen this, not only do I teach a certain group of students, but I lecture quite widely, with the internet, they can get up to speed. So, for example, I bring John Dean into my class. And they didn't know anything about Watergate because it wasn't going to be on the SATs and it wasn't dealt with in high school. And high school didn't even get to Vietnam or anything. But John Dean here and we're talking about, you know, this thing called Watergate. And by that weekend, they know more than their parents and their grandparents. And they can get, if they're interested. You have this tool. There is nothing more useful, and hopefully it will not be destroyed, than Wikipedia. Wikipedia is an incredible model, and it's not always right. But I love the fact that Wikipedia has now stepped up against the surveillance state and said, you are destroying this not-for-profit model because people have to trust us, and their privacy matters, and they have to be able to go on the internet and not be worried that somebody's looking over their shoulder. First of all, let me just say, in my lifetime, I've seen a lot of progress, okay? A lot of progress. That sometimes people forget. But my parents were garment workers, you know? In fact, my mother was an undocumented alien, all right, from Lithuania, because she was a union organizer and everything, and somehow, you know, lawyers told her you're not going to get papers or what have you. And my parents weren't even married. And we lived on welfare for the first, you know, years of my life, because I was born the worst year of the Depression, and my father lost his job and so forth. So I know something about, you know, the improved economic situation. And, you know, like Ronald Reagan, I'll say Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a great hero in my house, and I'll go to my grave admiring Franklin Delano Roosevelt, because whatever else he didn't do, and he didn't do this and didn't do that, fact of the matter is, you know, the trade union movement, Social Security, all of these things, for me, have been great victories. Public education. Now, unfortunately, we've attacked public education and demonized teachers and everything. But, you know, I grew up in the Bronx with public schools. I went to, you know, a couple of stations away from Colin Powell. If you want to see a tribute to the New Deal, read his autobiography. We were in the same class at City College, which is one of the best universities we ever had in this country, New York City College, City College in New York. And so, you know, I've seen a lot of progress. I've seen gay issues. I had one of my closest friends growing up, Melvin Coopersmith. He committed suicide, you know, as a young adult, you know, because of the horrible treatment of gay people. Another friend of mine, Carl Jurgens, couldn't play, you know, until Jackie Robinson came in. He wouldn't have been able to play professional baseball, you know, and then so I saw that change. You know, I get depressed about the stupid wars we fight, but I don't believe in being despairing and cynical, because it's a cop-out. It's a way of saying, okay, I'm not going to do anything. And we've had victories. I'll just give you an example, the difference between California and Texas. My wife, Narda Zucchino, just finished a book on this. And the big difference is what? That here, the Democratic Party does provide a model of enlightened governance under the second coming of Jerry Brown. Why? Because the Latino vote has been tapped. And you know, people like Dolores Huerta and others from the farm workers, instead of being a marginal movement, they now have are able to move a big base. And, you know, so you can't demonize immigrants. And as a result, the politics of California are progressive compared to the politics of Texas that are reactionary. So I see a lot of battles being won. Gay rights, which I just mentioned. You know, I'm thrilled that the Utah legislature has now accepted that gay people are people and entitled to human rights. And the Mormon Church has even changed. The Pope seems to be slowly changing. So, you know, no, yes, I think we can win these fights. On the book, stuff that I wrote the book about, I think we're going to win because the government is at odds with the needs of multinational capitalism. If it becomes crony capitalism, if it's subject to a police state, you know, if it betrays its own people, then it becomes this dark, regressive force, which is what is happening now. And so, yes, I think we're going to have a lively debate about this. And I'm thinking at the end, we're going to win. By we, I mean people who believe in freedom and believe that it's exciting and fun to be free. And it leads to better governance, better society, you know. And so, yeah, I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't think it was important and enjoyable.
Sometimes I think the only way we could actually activate our entire populace into becoming, you know, involved, active citizens would be to threaten to take away their cable, you know.
Yeah, I'm going to take you on here.
All right.
Okay. And it's interesting because when I was growing up, you know, my family is working class people. I was the first one to go to college on my father's side of the family. And people were tool and die makers and welders and all this kind of stuff, and garment workers and what have you. And I always resented when I finally got to the college level, the sort of dismissal of people like that, you know, and with this kind of argument, oh, all they want to do is shop or make a choice or figure out who should come to the family event or something. And I say, you know, you don't realize this is the only, well, they're arguing about sports, because it's the only area where they can trust the information. It never occurred to anyone. I said, why do you think people argue, should you move the outfield 10 degrees over, you know, with this hitter? And should you bring in a left-handed pitcher? And what should you do? And, you know, I said, the reason they're doing that is it's a controlled environment in which they trust the statistics. They trust what they're told, you know, and therefore the discussion becomes valid, you know. When you come to politics, that's when they're lied to routinely, and particularly foreign policy. That's when lying is the norm, and they're deceived, and they can't trust the information.
Yeah, I think that people do not feel like their vote, their opinion for sure, but even their votes, that they don't really affect anything. That
they've been betrayed.
They feel disempowered.
They've been, we, not they, we've been, look, come on. I went to vote Tuesday last week or two. We have this election for municipal in California at an odd time. It was a big pain in the neck. And I go there, and I looked at it, and I said, damn it, there isn't anything here that really interests me. You know, there really isn't in that particular thing because, you know, I don't trust any of it. I really don't. You know, are you telling me this one make a better city council person than that one? Well, each one is going to betray us in different ways. You know, I know that's not the way what you're supposed to say. I'm supposed to put that little sticker on. I voted. And I'm supposed to be very proud. And I didn't feel that way. I voted for Dianne Feinstein, I think, every time she ran. That woman has betrayed until quite recently. She finally did something right on the torture report. You know, yes. But, you know, the woman, she...
Isn't she the best of the worst, though?
Well, I don't even know what that means anymore because, you know, I mean, really, let's think about it. It's a trap. I'm not saying I'm not going to vote, and I'm not saying we're not going to write about these things. I'm not going to try to sort it out, but I'm not going to be gut-checked. And this is a long-winded response to your original question. I don't feel contempt for people who say it's all rigged and I'm not going to vote. I don't feel contempt for them. I understand. Then I try to figure out, okay, how can I reach you in some way? And sometimes it does matter, but I keep getting betrayed. For goodness sake, what we're talking about with the surveillance state, my whole book, I voted for Obama. I contributed money to Obama. You know, this guy has been worse than you know, Bush and Nixon.
He was our hope.
Yeah, and look what he's done. This is a constitutional law professor, very smart, knows these issues real well, and drinks the Kool-Aid and tells us that, you know, we have to surveil everybody in the world to get some bad guys.
To
and
be
then,
safe. So
and then, you know,
safer.
He can't come up with a single instance where that has happened. You know, I mean, the thing is nuts. You know, he betrayed us on the banks. Here was a guy I was supported because I thought, you know, in April of 08 when he was first running, he gives a speech blasting Wall Street, talking about how we got into this mess. And then after he defeats Hillary, he turns to the same Wall Street bankers and these people like Lawrence Summers, you know, and Robert Rubin and all these people. And oh, they're going to bail us out. Timothy Geithner, who did the deal for AIG, and we'll make him Secretary of Treasury. So it can make you cynical. But the electoral game is not the main game. It's not.
Change, that positive change ultimately is going to occur on a more local level, on a smaller scale, more provincially?
I know that's very appealing in Portland to argue that way. And let me say, there are some things that have happened in Portland that have been truly inspiring to me. If I can take credit, I came up here to observe the traffic calming procedures that have been pioneered in Portland. And I happened to have a local column. I went back to Santa Monica and I crusaded. So if you go to Santa Monica, California now, you will find many things that you're familiar with in Portland as far as extending the sidewalk and traffic calming, the three E's I learned in engineering education and enforcement of pedestrian rights, bike lanes, and so forth. And we're getting actually quite a bit of that in Los Angeles now. So I am for local experimentation. I am for learning locally. I'm for education, local control of education in the main, as long as we respect the human rights of people and not have segregation or something. But yes, I believe in local control. I also believe we need to bring back some community type organizing like unions at the workplace and so forth, because it's really hopeless to try to fight against some of these things. And it has to be international. I think you can't really improve working conditions and the real problem we're having with income inequality if we don't improve the conditions of people working in other places. So if they can get this cheap labor, and particularly cheap skill labor that they can get, then there isn't much reason to go to college here. You know, you're going to be beaten down anyway. And I think the two big issues for our time are the content of democracy. Are we free? Can we act? Can we learn about what we need to learn about it? Can we get the bad guys? Can we convince the other people there are alternatives? You know, can we? I don't like the rah-rah patriotism, but I do feel that this country is a repository of very important discussion and ideas about equality, or equality of opportunity, certainly, meaningful governance, informed public. And I do think that's the battleground on which we should be fighting. You know, holding up your finger with a purple stain on it in Iraq is not an example of freedom. Okay, so just having the vote and being conned into voting a certain way, and the role of money now, the big money, and buying, our attention and buying our allegiance and everything is a disgusting parody of the democratic experience. There's no doubt about it. We're insulting the ideas of a Tom Paine or a Jefferson. We're mocking them to the world because those people believed in substance. But the fact is, at the heart of it was an idea of people comprehending what was being done to them, and, the ones who got to vote. All right, right. Grant you that, and that it had to be an informed vote, or it didn't mean anything. And we've lost that. We live in in the Brave New World society, and it
feels
really
very complacent to me.
Well, it's complacent except when it doesn't work, and then what they've been able to do is effectively crush movements of protests, like the Occupy movement, was brutally crushed in this country. Everybody's going on about Putin and Russia and this thing. The fact of the matter is, we had a mass movement right across the country raising very legitimate questions about income distribution and how the economy got screwed up and what was going on. And there was a very important teaching element to it, an educational element. And it was crushed primarily, with the only exception of that supposed liberal Republican mayor.
We have, I'm pretty sure that one of our rights is to assemble peacefully in public. And so what they do is they say, well, your public place to assemble is over in that free speech zone, in that little caged area.
So it's
area.
No longer public. I don't know if it applies to Portland. It sure applies to Los Angeles and Santa Monica and Beverly Hills and everything. You're supporting local government with a deeply regressive tax of parking tickets and towing and everything of people who really can't afford it.
Right.
It's a vicious thing, and yet it's paying for your bloody jobs in the middle of a recession. That struck me as a really frightening divide of the people who were being taken care of. So they were like now the good Germans, look the other way when these occupiers are scooped up and pushed away. And that was extremely depressing. But the reason to be optimistic again goes back to that crack and everything. We can't sustain the income divide. The thing that my book is about the privacy, not just the privacy, the sovereignty of the individual. And if you try to sustain these other contradictions by the surveillance culture, which can be made very intimidating, I don't think people fully understand that. How invasive this surveillance is now. I mean, they can really get to you. I don't know what. I mean, we've had people thrown in jail. Scott Ritter, for instance, I'm still really unhappy about his case. What was the government doing setting him up? Virtual sex on the internet. And the next thing you know, the guy who was one of our most effective critics on the whole Iraq war and really informed, suddenly he's in prison and somehow everyone looks the other way. And you just think they can pluck people out. Let me end this interview with a real, just at this point, people say, what does it matter? I don't know if people listening have listened to, watched the movie Selma. But, as editor of Ramparts, I published Martin Luther King when he came out against the Vietnam War. And I know how controversial he was at that time. you know, what the subtext in Selma was, you know, the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover tried to destroy Martin Luther King, tried to blackmail him and tried to get him to commit suicide with, they tapped into phones, they listened to his hotel and tried to say this guy, you know, was having an affairs and what have you, and therefore we'll tell his wife and we'll frame and we'll do it and so forth. Had they had the modern means of surveillance that we have now, they would have succeeded. They would have succeeded because now you can know every minute of every hour of somebody's life. You can plant material. You can entrap. You can make stuff up. You can doctor photographs. You can doctor conversations. You can go wild, and you can you know, and you're anonymous, and you could
it's beyond Orwell what you're describing.
Yeah, and it will suddenly be all over the internet, and this guy will be defamed so many different ways, and destroyed. It's an enormous power, but you don't even have to use it because once people have the idea that the government, or they have the power, then you do self-censorship and you're intimidated.
Well, that's right.
Yeah, and that's where we are now. It's, you know, all those people who say, well, you know, I'm not going to do anything wrong that'll get the government. Oh, really? Is that true, Mrs. Zuckerberg? Then why are you worried so much about having non-disclosure agreements with all the people who work at your house? In on 21 Dolores, San Francisco, or even the fact that I mentioned 21 Dolores Street, San Francisco. You don't even want that known, you know. Why? Because you have a legitimate concern about privacy. You do. And anybody has a legitimate, not just famous rich people, has a legitimate concern that there be some zone where they're not being observed by people working on their house or their neighbors or the police. One thing I think is what people will increasingly become aware is that privacy is not something you do out of, you know, because you have to hide. Privacy is the lifeblood of freedom.
Right. It's an entitlement.
It's you keep saying entitlement. What do you mean by entitlement?
I mean, as a human being and as a citizen of the United States of America, I feel that I am entitled to keep information about me private, about my daily coming and goings, my communications, unless I choose to share them.
And I feel like I'm
entitled to that.
Okay, I don't think you're entitled. I mean, you are entitled to that, but that interests me less than as a citizen. You know, if people want to go live in a totalitarian society, if they want to deny that part of their humanity, that's something else. You know, there are cultures that have been quite repressive and conforming, but that's not what our country is supposed to be all about.
Right.
And it's not what we've trumpeted to the world. You know, when I get up at the Laker game and I'm singing the Star Spangled Banner and conforming because, you know, you don't see anybody sit down. I would like somebody to whisper, Francis Scott Key, you know, he actually was quite a rebel. And he really wasn't this super flag-waving patriot, you know. And these guys, they were quite complex, and they had different opinions, and they were very concerned about conformity. And in fact, if they were concerned about conformity, if they were favored conformity, they wouldn't have rebelled against the king in the first place. And so the word entitlement just bothers me, because the Constitution, yes, it does say, you know, in our Declaration of Independence, certainly affirms human rights and the right of the individual. But I think it's more than, or it's more specific than entitlement. It's a necessity for representative democracy or governance to work. Privacy. There's some area where you're not being observed, where you can think, where you can mutter, try organizing with your friends, try figuring something out, a better way of doing it. Challenge the orthodox. Say, no, maybe the Pentagon's wrong, maybe the FBI's wrong, maybe the president's wrong, maybe this is wrong, whatever, and I want to come up with something different. And what we're stifling is any kind of creative challenge to the status quo, and even at a time right. when we know the status quo is not working.
Robert Scheer, I am so happy to have you here in the studio today. I am Rabia Yemin for The Digital Divide. I have been talking with Robert Scheer about his newest book, They Know Everything About You, How Data Collecting Corporations and Snooping Government Agencies Are Destroying Democracy. Good luck on your tour, and it's been a real pleasure to talk with you today.
Let's hope some people still read books. Bye.
Thank you. Thank you.
just another day. It's just another day on earth. Oh, it's just another day. Just another day. It's just another day on earth. It's just another day on earth. It's just another day on earth. One day we will put it all behind. We'll say that was just another time. We'll say just another day on earth. We say that was just another time. One day we will put it all behind. We say that was just another day on
It's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, April 10th. For KBOO News, I'm Kristen Yount. A United Nations rapporteur, Rita Isaac, called for an end to discrimination against the Roma, or gypsies. The announcement came on International Roma Day, that was last Wednesday, April 8th. A year ago, a leaked note from the Parisian police chief gave orders for the police of Paris to expel Roma from the city. Amnesty International estimated last year that there are 12 million Roma living in Europe, many of whom fear they will be forcibly evicted. The 20,000 or so Roma living in France do so in extreme poverty. In the state of Georgia, the